Chapter 9, Traditions and Individual Talents. Staying at Burma Raja's guest cottage had both advantages and disadvantages. The principal disadvantage was that I was so far from the bazaar and from the YMBA. Unless I actually went along to Banshilal's godown in the evening and took part in the activities, I hardly ever saw our members, which was certainly not good for the development of our work. 2 miles was not a long way to walk, especially for a hillman, but people who lived in the bazaar were not accustomed to paying visits in the development area, to them another world, and it seemed that the majority of my students were simply unable to overcome their habit of not walking in that particular direction. Even Sachin, Lachiman and Dawa came to see me only very occasionally. The principal advantage of staying at the guest cottage was, of course, that I could enjoy the peace and quietness of the place. But it also brought me into closer contact with several well-known Kalimpong residents who lived in that quarter of the town. During the 6 months that I spent with Burma Raja, I came to know 2 or 3 of these quite well, and through them a number of other people of different religious traditions and different individual talents. Some of the people I came to know lived in quite splendid houses. Beyond the guest cottage, on a lower level still, at the far end of a lawn flanked by fruit trees, stood Manjula, with its own guest cottage, in this case a medium-sized house, even further down. Manjula was the summer residence of Mrs. Charu Mitta, otherwise known as the Queen of Kalimpong. The lady's right to this title was not altogether undisputed, some people disloyally maintaining that she was not Queen of Kalimpong at all, but only Queen of the local Bengalis. Be that as it may, there were undoubtedly Bengalis in the town, especially during the summer months. And if there was such a thing as Bengali society, Mrs. Mitta was undoubtedly its leader, or even its queen. Every year she came up to Kalimpong for the hottest part of the season, bringing with her her small daughter, Manjula, after whom the house was named, her Bengali cook, and her Nepalese ayah. Her husband, who was an architect, arrived later than she did and left earlier, staying altogether only 2 or 3 weeks. Once settled at Manjula, Mrs. Mitta gave tea parties, entertained women friends and relations from the plains, and pulled numerous small strings in the world of predominantly Bengali officialdom. She had even succeeded in getting a whole section of road between the lower cart road and her own front gate tarred and gravelled by the municipality. Now that the British had gone, the local Bengalis regarded themselves as the ruling class, not to say the master race, and expected everything to be done for their convenience. Some of them, in fact, looked down on the hill people as an inferior breed. "They're so backward," was the usual cry, an attitude the hill people themselves deeply resented. It was with reference to this arrogant and overbearing attitude on the part of the Bengalis that Mrs. Mitta had been given the title by which she was generally, if ironically, known. For if she was Queen of the Bengalis, and if the Bengalis ruled Kalimpong, then Queen of Kalimpong she must assuredly be. I had met Mrs. Mitta the previous year when she attended one of our Sunday lectures at the Dharmodaya Vihara, but this had been my only contact with her. Swale, on the other hand, knew the lady quite well. When visiting Panorama, he had always made a point of calling at Manjula too, and from him she had not only learned how the YMBA was progressing, but also imbibed a strong dislike for Joe. Now that I was staying at the Panorama guest cottage, and she herself was back in Kalimpong for the season, she was forever sending her elderly Nepalese gardener up to me with messages and with Bengali curries and sweetmeats in little covered dishes. In these circumstances, it was inevitable that I should become better acquainted with her and be drawn to some extent into her social circle. Not liking to refuse all her invitations, which were often quite pressing, I used to go down to see her in the morning sometimes, when she would entertain me very hospitably with tea and Bengali sweetmeats. Once or twice I put in an appearance at her afternoon tea parties, though I disappointed her by not bringing with me Burma Raja and the princess, who had also been invited, so that she had to content herself with having captured Prince Peter. Dinner parties were, of course, out of the question for me, as I still adhered to the rule of not taking solid food after midday. My hostess was a woman of about 40, inclining to stoutness, with a round, rather ugly face, on which there at times appeared an expression of extreme hardness. Though she was in many ways quite westernised and spoke excellent English, Mrs. Mitter invariably wore the graceful Bengali sari. In the morning this was of white cotton with the red border that denoted a married woman whose husband was still living. In the afternoon it was of heavy silk, hand-printed in what I came to recognise as the Shantiniketan style, a style based on motifs adapted from Bengali folk art. When she went out, Mrs. Mitter draped the edge of her sari over her head, which together with her attendant Aya and her formidable expression made her look for all the world like a Roman matron of senatorial family on her way to a good seat at the gladiatorial shows. Mrs. Mitter was, in fact, of a somewhat domineering disposition. I had not been to see her more than a couple of times before she was trying to pull a few strings in the little world of the YMBA. "I should make much more use of that nice Colonel Ryan," she told me, "and get rid of that dreadful Major Can, whom nobody liked." By this time I was accustomed to my older friends thinking that I was young and inexperienced and in need of their advice, and I therefore kept my own counsel. I knew quite well, however, that strong as was Mrs. Mitter's dislike for Joe, it was fully reciprocated. When they happened to meet, he was always careful to be extremely polite to her, raising his hat and inquiring after her health in the most solicitous manner, all of which she acknowledged with a stiff half-smile. But as soon as she was out of hearing, it was another story. "She's a very hard woman," he would breathe half to himself, absent-mindedly twisting an imaginary neck. Domineering and hard though she might be, Mrs. Mitter was meekness and gentleness itself when her husband was around, at least in public. This was illustrated by an amusing incident that occurred soon after the latter's arrival in Kalimpong, when Swale and I were talking with him on the veranda. Happening to want a box of matches, Mr. Mitter, a gross-featured, corpulent man, who spent the day lounging about in singlet and lungi, suddenly raised his voice and shouted for his wife, who was inside the house. In an instant she was in the doorway, her mouth full of food, without even pausing to wash the hand with which she had been eating. "Just see how obedient these Hindu wives are," exclaimed Mr. Mitter in mock deprecation, as Swale let out a hearty guffaw. "They come whenever we call them." Then, turning to his wife, he added in a milder tone, "I'm sorry, my dear, I didn't know you were taking your meal." Mrs. Mitter blushed like a girl at this, and there was a good deal of laughter at her expense, in which she herself could not help joining. After this incident, Swale was forever joking with Mrs. Mitter about her being a model of wifely obedience, always coming the instant her lord and master called. Strange to say, that formidable lady never seemed to mind him joking with her in this way, even though he sometimes carried the joke so far as to put even a Hindu wife on the defensive, so that she felt constrained to justify herself. "It's the way we've been brought up," she would protest with an apologetic laugh. Swale's only reply to this was an enormous guffaw. Observing them together, it was soon clear to me that far from minding the way in which he joked with her, Mrs. Mitter actually quite enjoyed it, and that his boisterous jocularity was very much to her taste. Unlike the unfortunate Joe, My gregarious friend was in fact extremely popular with her, and there was no doubt that if the Queen of Kalimpong had a court, then Swale was the favourite courtier. Such was Swale's popularity with Mrs. Mitter, indeed, that she viewed the prospect of his leaving Kalimpong with considerable dismay. When she learned that her string-pulling in the world of the YMBA had not been as successful as her string-pulling in the world of Bengali officialdom, and that I had decided to get rid of nice Colonel Ryan rather than the dreadful Major Can, she was extremely displeased and lost no time in telling me so. Though I continued to see her, the lady's attitude towards me underwent a marked change, cordiality being replaced by coolness, and when she came up to Kalimpong in subsequent years, she always took good care to let me know that she still had not forgiven me for preferring Joe to Swale, and probably never would. As for her attitude towards Joe himself, whom she regarded as being at the bottom of all the mischief, this underwent a marked change too, her dislike for him becoming more deeply rooted than ever. His politeness was now acknowledged not with a stiff half-smile, but with a disapproving stare or a look of profound distaste. There was, of course, no reason why Swale should not have stayed on in Kalimpong even after ceasing to work for the YMBA. There was no interruption of our friendly personal relations. But his ties with the place were loose. He was conscious that he had outstayed his welcome as a guest of the Joshi family, and before the sun was out, he was gone. Damodaran wanted to see his family in Malabar, he told me cheerily before his departure. They would spend some time in South India, then return to Calcutta. After that, he did not know what he would do. Perhaps he would go back to Burma and let them take a few more pot shots at him. Perhaps he would get a job in Assam. Though the change in Mrs. Mitter's attitude towards me was so marked, I found it as difficult as ever to account for her extreme displeasure at my getting rid of Swale rather than Joe. Clearly, she believed that it was his ceasing to work for the YMBA that had been mainly responsible for his departure from Kalimpong. But it seemed strange nonetheless that she should take the loss of her favourite so much to heart that she could become cold to me and positively rude to Joe. Did she enjoy his company to such an extent that she resented being deprived of it? Or was she a woman who was so accustomed to having her own way that she resented being thwarted when once she had made her wishes known? Had the little YMBA puppets given offence by not dancing in the way she wanted them to dance, when she had, as she supposed, given a good jerk on the right strings? There was no doubt that the answer to these questions was in the affirmative, but in the end I concluded that the real reason for Mrs. Mitter's change of attitude was to be found in a region the importance of which I, as a monk, had tended to overlook, the region of matchmaking. Not long after her arrival in Kalimpong, Mrs. Mitter had been joined by her school teacher niece, Miss Bose, a short, extremely plump girl with a toothy smile and an incipient moustache. The fact that Miss Bowes was still unmarried must have been very much on her aunt's mind. Even I knew that 25, or thereabouts, was very late indeed for a girl to be lingering in the marriage market, and perhaps I should have attached greater significance than I did to the fact that Swale was permitted to associate with Miss Bowes far more freely than was customary even in quite westernised Hindu families. He even took her out for a walk once or twice, unchaperoned. However, though Swale plainly enjoyed the plump niece's company, and she apparently his, and though in a moment of enthusiasm he once went so far as to describe her as bedworthy, an expression I had not heard before, I gave no more thought to the matter than if Miss Bowes had been an English girl. Only in retrospect did I see that from Mrs. Mitter's point of view, things must have seemed to be moving in a certain direction, a direction of which she herself must have approved, if not actively encouraged. Indeed, it was more than likely that the solicitous aunt had been indulging in a little unobtrusive matchmaking on her niece's behalf, and had actually contrived to bring the whole situation about. If such was indeed the case, and if Mrs. Mitter had been relying on Swale's work for the YMBA to keep him in Kalimpong long enough for things to be brought to a successful conclusion, then my decision to get rid of the nice colonel rather than the dreadful major must have ruined all her plans. No wonder she was so displeased with me. At the same time, I knew quite well that from Swale's own point of view, there had been no question of things moving in a certain direction, or indeed in any direction. Even if some of the things Joe said about him were not true, I was convinced that, likely as he seemed to take his anagaric ordination, he would never forget himself so far as to espouse Miss Bowes, however bedworthy the plump girl might be. Indeed, I was inclined to think that, unobtrusive as Mrs. Mitter's matchmaking had been, it had not escaped Swale's notice, and that he left Kalimpong partly in order to avoid complications. Whatever the truth of the matter may have been, before my decision to get rid of Swale became generally known, and when Mrs. Mitter's attitude towards me was still one of cordiality, she introduced me to a number of people in her circle. The most interesting and important of these was Mrs. Pratima Tagore, the niece and daughter-in-law of the poet, who lived practically next door to Mrs. Mitter in a house called Chitrabanu. I soon realised that Pratima Devi, as she was generally called, occupied a position of special preeminence in the local Bengali community, and that if Mrs. Mitter was the queen of Kalimpong, she was the queen mother. This was due not merely to the fact that she was related to the poet both by blood and by marriage. For Bengalis, Tagore was the poet in much the same way that for the medieval schoolman, Aristotle was the philosopher. But also to the fact that she was a woman of unusual beauty of character, who from girlhood onwards had been especially close to him. It was in order to make sure of not losing her companionship that Tagore had, so I gathered, arranged for her to marry his son Rabindranath. Since the great man's death 10 years earlier, Pratima Devi had come to be revered as the guardian of his memory, as the upholder of his ideals, and as the protectress of Shantiniketan, the complex of educational and cultural activities which Tagore had created some 90 miles north of Calcutta. Shantiniketan was, in fact, a sort of shrine to which admirers of the poet resorted not only from all over Bengal, but from many parts of the world, and Pratima Devi was the high priestess of the shrine, who kept the lamps burning and safeguarded the purity of the cult. Every year, however, she passed the summer months in Kalimpong, just as Mrs. Mitter did, and the two ladies were on terms of intimacy. Mrs. Mitter, in fact, spent a good deal of her time with Mrs. Tagore, often running down to Chitrabanu with something she had cooked, or with an item of gossip, as many as 3 or 4 times in the course of a single day. Whether they were on terms of intimacy because they were neighbours, or because they were the two most prominent figures of local Bengali society, it was difficult to tell. Probably each of these circumstances played a part. There was also the fact of their common religious background. Both Mrs. Mitter and Mrs. Tagore belonged to families long connected with the Brahmo Samaj, the Hindu reformist movement started by Raja Ramohan Roy more than 100 years earlier. The poet's father, Deependranath Tagore, popularly known as the Maharshi or Great Sage, had in fact been one of the leaders of the movement, the influence of which was still widely, if thinly, diffused throughout Bengal. Whatever the reason may have been, on terms of intimacy, the two ladies undoubtedly were. And thus it came about that one afternoon Mrs. Mitter took me down to Chitrabanu to see Pratima Devi, who had more than once expressed a wish to meet me. Even away from her shrine, Pratima Devi looked not unlike a high priestess. Like Mrs. Mitter, she wore the Bengali sari, but in her case it was predominantly white or cream in colour, and slightly starched, so that it fell to her feet in stiff, straight folds. Though still in her middle 50s, she was not only rather emaciated, but quite frail, as if recently recovered from a long illness. And when she rose from the Shantiniketan-style couch on which she had been sitting and advanced towards me, it was evident that she moved with some difficulty. Soon we were talking, while Mrs. Mitter bustled about supervising the serving of tea. Despite her thin face and rather sharp features, Pratima Devi had a complexion like the petal of a magnolia flower. It was not difficult to see that as a young woman she must have been quite beautiful. One of her first questions was the one that was, plainly, uppermost in her mind. Had I been to Shantiniketan? From the way in which she put the question, it was clear that, often as she must have asked it, for her it was no mere formality. She really wanted to know. Unfortunately, I had to admit that I had not been to Shantiniketan, adding, quite truthfully, that I hoped to go there before very long. "Oh, you must go," she responded fervently, a rapturous look transfiguring her worn face. "I'm sure you would like it there. Even though it isn't what it was when Gurudev was alive, Shantiniketan is a wonderful place." The high-pitched, rather quavering voice in which Pratima Devi uttered these words made them sound all the more impressive, as though the high priestess had momentarily become the inspired prophetess. I also noticed that she pronounced the word Gurudev, or Divine Master, as she called her father-in-law, with profound reverence, though at the same time in a manner which was wholly spontaneous and natural. Her devotion to the poet's memory was, in fact, wonderful to behold. Whenever his name was mentioned or his work referred to, her pale features would be suddenly illumined with an inner glow. It was as though an alabaster lamp had been lit in the shrine. Even when Tagore was not the theme, there was a quality of transparency and luminosity about Pratima Devi, which, combined with her dignity and sweetness, her perfect courtesy, and her refined, aristocratic manners, created the impression of a being from another world. Beside her, poor Mrs. Mitter looked thoroughly coarse and plebeian. When we had talked for about half an hour and I was drinking my second cup of tea, we were joined by a tall, thin man of about 60, with shoulder-length grey hair and a decidedly melancholy look. This was Mrs. Tagore's husband, Rathindranath, the poet's son. Though the house had been built to his own design, and though he had made the Shantiniketan-style furniture with his own hands, it seemed somehow as though he did not really belong to the place. After a few minutes he left us, and I never saw him again, though I continued to see Mrs. Tagore for a good many years. Being the poet's son was much more difficult than being his daughter-in-law. Rathindranath had not only grown up very much in his great father's shadow, but grown up almost entirely lacking in talent, in a family where talent, not to speak of genius, was the rule rather than the exception. His sole talent was for woodwork and leatherwork, and this, despite the poet's own more enlightened attitude, was not to be compared, in caste-ridden India at least, with her talent for the more liberal arts of poetry, music and painting. No wonder the clean-shaven brown face had such a melancholy look. Lack of talent had not been Rathindranath's only problem, however. As Mrs. Mitter had already told me, though not in so many words, the poet's son had never had a career of his own. Until recently, in fact, he had not had a life of his own. Even his marriage to Pratima Devi had been arranged more with a view to providing his father with a daughter-in-law than himself with a wife. As arranged, marriages were customary in Bengal, as elsewhere in India, and usually turned out quite well. It was therefore not surprising that the union had not been a success. Indeed, a few weeks after our brief encounter, I learned that he had run away from Shantiniketan with a woman much younger than himself, and that the couple had settled in Dehradun. Perhaps Rathindranath had come out from his father's shadow at last. As for Mrs. Tagore, she bore the shock of her husband's defection without complaint, and was duly invested by her women friends with a halo of martyrdom, which she wore with her usual dignity. Morals were indeed changing in West Bengal in more ways than one. The fact that Mrs. Mitter could think of Swale as a possible husband for her niece showed that the old caste barriers had crumbled to some extent. Interracial marriages were not unknown among the westernised professional classes, and it was therefore not surprising that, through Mrs. Mitter, I should come to know two European women who had married Bengali Hindus. Both Etta Ghosh and Irene Ray had, in their different ways, completely identified themselves with the society and the culture into which they had married, and of which they were, in a sense, now part. Indeed, I sometimes thought that they were more Bengali than the Bengalis. Both wear Bengali saris, both spoke the Bengali language, both cooked and ate in Bengali style, and both were, for all practical purposes, Bengali Hindus. Etta Ghosh's sari was, however, pure white, without the traditional red border. Her husband, a well-known doctor, had suddenly collapsed and died at Manjula itself, only 2 years earlier, when they were staying with Mrs. Mitter for the summer holidays. A plump, brisk, motherly woman, she was now a teacher at Shantiniketan, and warmly invited me to stay with her when I paid my promised visit to the place. "She would cook me a goulash," she declared, on learning that I was of partly Hungarian descent. She herself had been born in Hungary, not far from Budapest, and she had not forgotten how to make the national dish. Irene Ray had been more fortunate than Etta Ghosh. She was still entitled to wear the red border. Her husband, another doctor, was still living, but had been left behind in Calcutta to look after his practice while she spent a few weeks in the cooler air of the hills. She was taller and slimmer than Etta, besides being more serious-minded, and, like myself, she had been born in England. What was more, she was a native of South London, in fact, a native of Tooting. It seemed strange to be sitting there in Mrs. Mitter's garden within sight of Mount Kanchenjunga, talking to someone who knew Tooting Broadway as well as I knew it myself. While Etta was content with pujas and devotional songs, Irene was a serious student of Indian philosophy and religion, and a regular contributor to the house journals of various religious movements. Though she knew something about Buddhism, her real interest was in the Advaita, or non-dualist, tradition of the Vedanta, as popularly expounded by the Swamis of the Ramakrishna Mission. She was, in fact, a devotee of the mission, as well as being an active supporter of the Mission's Institute of Culture in Calcutta, with which I myself had been associated some 4 or 5 years earlier. Since then, the Institute had moved from its old home in Wellington Square to spacious new premises in Russell Road, and activities had expanded considerably. Besides attending lectures and anniversary celebrations, Irene helped with administrative work. In this way, she had come to know several people whom I had known. Among these were Swami Nityaswarupananda, the scheming and ambitious secretary of the Institute, and Kantaraj, his ever-helpful assistant, both of whom still remembered me. Despite her practical involvement with the Institute, however, Irene Ray was no mere organisation woman. Her interest in the contemplative disciplines of the Advaita Vedanta was deep and genuine. Though I had met her through Mrs. Mitter, she had come up to Kampong not to enjoy a holiday, but to make a spiritual retreat, and she was staying not at Manjula, as Etta was, but at the local Ramakrishna ashram. The ashram was situated at the highest point of the development area, 300 or 400 feet above panorama. Though no more quiet and secluded than my cottage, it commanded an even finer view of Mount Kanchenjunga, as well as of several adjacent peaks. Irene was staying not at the ashram proper, but in the very comfortable guest house, and before leaving, she invited me for tea there. I had visited the ashram once or twice before, and had already met both the Swami in charge and his assistant, who was still a brahmachari. In the Ramakrishna order, a Swami was equivalent to a bhikshu or full monk, and a brahmachari to a shramanera or novice. While the brahmachari, a comparatively young man, was a very popular figure in the town, the Swami was almost universally disliked. The reason for this strange state of affairs was that whereas the brahmachari was a person of great warmth and friendliness, Swami Gangeshwarananda, as the older man was called, was not only rude and intolerant in the extreme, but seemingly consumed by a black hatred for everything and everybody. He was in fact an even better example of Buddha Ghosha's person of angry temperament than was Venerable Aniruddha himself. Aniruddha, it could be said, was merely bad-tempered, though he became angry easily enough. In between the bouts of anger, he could be quite cheerful and, in his own rough way, even friendly. Gangeshwarananda, however, had an evil temper. He was never cheerful and never friendly, for the black demon by which he was possessed gave him no respite. If Aniruddha's anger was like the sudden blazing up of fire, Gangeshwarananda's was like the constant dripping of poison from the fangs of a cobra. Why he should be in such a state after more than 30 years in the Ramakrishna order, one could only speculate. Yet in it he was. The authorities of the mission had indeed posted him to Kalimpong only because his evil temper could do less harm there than elsewhere. Since the Kalimpong ashram had been built as a place of rest and recuperation for senior swamis and well-to-do devotees, it conducted no public activities, and all the swami in charge had to do was to keep the buildings in good repair and make sure that guests did not leave without paying. This swami Gangeshwarananda certainly did. He also lectured occasionally, besides visiting the few Bengali houses where he was still welcome. One of these was Manjula. Though Mrs. Mitter disliked him, her husband was a devotee, or at least a supporter, of the Ramakrishna mission, and according to Joe, the Swami never left without a 100-rupee note being slipped into his hand. Whether I first met him at Manjula or at the ashram, it is no longer possible for me to say. Wherever it was, we had not talked for more than a few minutes before I realised that he nursed a particular hatred for Buddhism. So strong was this hatred that 2 years later it burst forth at a public meeting in a virulent personal attack on the Buddha, an attack which gave great offence to Buddhists and Hindus alike, and lost him what little sympathy people still felt for him. As a member of the Ramakrishna mission, the Swami was, of course, a believer in universalism. He subscribed to the view that all religions are one, and all worthy, therefore, of the same respect and admiration. This made his hatred for Buddhism all the more unaccountable. In the circumstances, I could only suppose that, though all religions were one, some were more and some less one than others. Universalism of a more sophisticated kind was, however, also to be found in the neighbourhood, not to speak of more amiable universalists. During my stay with Burma Raja, I came into contact with someone who, though connected with the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, was at the same time a follower of the elitist universalism of René Guénon and his school. This was none other than Marco Pallas, otherwise known as Thubten Tenzin, the London-born author of Peaks and Lamas. I had first heard of him in Singapore when my old friend Arnold Price wrote me an enthusiastic letter about the then little-known work, which he strongly urged me to read. Read it I did, thus getting my first real insight into Tibetan Buddhism and my first glimpse of one of its most attractive and inspiring personalities, the 11th century poet saint Milarepa. Since then, I had very much wanted to meet Marco Palas, and it was with both surprise and delight that I learned, shortly after my arrival in Kangpong, that he was actually living in the town. He was not, however, a very easy man to approach. Though he attended one of Prince Peter's lectures, he disappeared immediately afterwards, and for the whole of the time that I was at the Dharmodia Vihara, my wish to meet him remained unfulfilled. Some time later, when we had come to know each other quite well, he admitted that he had been avoiding me. The reason for this rather strange behaviour was that, having read the short stories Swale had contributed to the first two issues of Stepping Stones, he had been afraid that my interest in Tibetan Buddhism might be limited to its more sensational occult and psychic aspects. A perusal of some of the more recent issues of the magazine had, fortunately, convinced him that this was not in fact the case, and hearing that I was now staying in the development area, not far from where he himself lived, he lost no time to seek me out. From that time onwards, we met frequently and became good friends. Usually we met at the guest cottage, he rightly thinking it more in accordance with Buddhist etiquette that he should visit me than that I should visit him, though he did once invite me up to his bungalow for a meal. The bungalow was situated at the top of a flight of irregular stone steps, and what with trees looming up behind and shrubs pressing in on either side, it was a sufficiently quiet and secluded place. Here Thubten La, as he liked to be called, lived with his friend Richard Nicholson, otherwise known as Thubten Shidab, the companion of the travels recorded in Peaks and Lamas. As lunch was not quite ready, he showed me round the place. Tibetan painted scrolls hung on the walls, and the polished wooden floors were covered with Tibetan rugs. There were silver butter lamps on the altar, and massive copper teapots on the sideboard, all gleaming in the shuttered semi-darkness. In one room I could just make out the unfamiliar shape of a harpsichord. What it was doing there I could not imagine, and neither Thubten La nor Shidab La offered any explanation. Only years later, long after they had left Kangpong, did I come to know that the two men were accomplished musicians with a special interest in early music. There was, in fact, quite a lot about Marco Palas that I did not know at the time, and the semi-darkness in which he seemed to live was perhaps not without significance. One was conscious that there were gleams other than those of silver and copper piercing the dense atmosphere of the place, and unfamiliar shapes other than that of the harpsichord rising up out of obscure corners. There were movements and currents in the air, as of unseen fish in deep waters, and even though one had no idea what it might be, one was vaguely aware of something going on behind the scenes. The bungalow was in fact very much like a cave, with treasures heaped just inside the entrance, but with a tunnel running from the back of the cave into the darkness, a tunnel down which Marco Palas disappeared from time to time, and which was the venue for all kinds of mysterious activities. Frequently, as we now met, the author of Peaks and Lamas and I always had a good deal to say to each other, and our talk covered an increasingly wide range of topics. Both of us were deeply concerned about the state of Buddhism in Kalimpong and the surrounding area, as well as about the decline of spiritual values in the modern world. On this latter topic, Marco Palas, in particular, felt very strongly. I felt less strongly, perhaps because I had seen less of the world than he had. And his ideas about why such a decline had taken place were clear and definite. It had taken place, so he believed, because of a growing lack of respect for tradition. Tradition being the whole body of thoughts, practices and institutions coming down to us from remote antiquity, insofar as these are informed by principles belonging, ultimately, to the metaphysical order. What made Marco Palas a universalist as well as a traditionalist was the fact that he also believed that the different individual traditions, such as Buddhism, Christianity and Islam, had all issued from one primordial tradition. It was in connection with his ideas about tradition, I think, that my new friend first mentioned to me the name of René Guénon, who, together with Ananda K. Kumaraswamy, had been, so it transpired, the immediate source of these ideas, as well as the main inspiration behind his thinking. He and Richard Nicholson had, in fact, translated several of Guénon's books into English, and copies of these works were soon put into my hands. As might have been expected, I found them of great interest. The idea of religion being a special form of tradition appealed to me strongly and enabled me to see the whole subject in a new light. Unfortunately, despite his universalism, the French savant was a victim of the same kind of selective blindness as the Bengali Swami, and some of his references to Buddhism showed actual prejudice against that religion. Perhaps he too was an example of a person of angry temperament. On my drawing Marco Palace's attention to the references in question, he promised to raise the matter with the author and to see that corrections were made in future editions of the volumes concerned. He was as good as his word, and some years later this was actually done. Meanwhile, though it had featured in my writings for a time, the idea of religion as a special form of tradition lost some of its initial appeal, and I came to attach less importance to such matters as the wearing of traditional dress, or rather came to see that the issues involved were less straightforward and simple than had at first appeared. In one respect at least, however, Marco Palace's ideas about tradition continued to influence me long after our meetings at Burma Raja's guest cottage had come to an end. This was in connection with the comparatively humble subject of handicrafts, and in particular that of the superiority of natural dyes, such as were traditionally used in Tibet, over their modern aniline substitutes. If in future years I was able to distinguish the subtler and richer effects of the one from the cruder and bolder effects of the other, it was largely owing to my contact with Marco Palace. For me, this was not so small a matter as it might seem. Colour is an integral part of our perception of the external world, but the quality of the colour perceived depends upon the degree of awareness and emotional sensitivity in the percipient. Only a beautiful soul can perceive beautiful colours. Much as I enjoyed my talks with Marco Palace, his visits to the guest's cottage were attended by one drawback. This was the effect they had upon Joe, who was still staying with me. Though he did not feel for Marco Palace the almost physical revulsion he felt towards Swale, in the older man's company he was extremely ill at ease and tended to behave with an abruptness that at first rather puzzled the visitor. The truth of the matter was that Marco Palace possessed those very advantages which Joe himself was so painfully conscious of lacking, and which were, therefore, most likely to activate his morbidly acute feelings of inferiority and inadequacy, feelings that in any case were never far from the surface. Marco Palace was the son of a diplomat, had been to public school and university, knew four or five languages, was highly articulate, and had written a book which, though by no means a bestseller, had won for the author a modest degree of fame. In these circumstances, it was not surprising that Joe, being the sort of person he was, should feel the way he did. At the same time, Marco Palace was so kind and courteous, and beamed at Joe with such evident goodwill, that the latter had no excuse for one of his usual petulant outbursts, or even for a display of prickliness. The result was that he felt more frustrated than ever, and as soon as Marco Palace had gone, I was treated, more often than not, to a variety of jeering comments on our unoffending visitors' opinions, personal appearance and mannerisms, or even to an angry tirade. Only one of Joe's comments had any real basis, and even that related to what was no more than a rather embarrassing habit. When expounding his favourite ideas, Marco Palace was liable to be so carried away by enthusiasm that not only did he get as close as possible to the person he was addressing, but actually thrust his face right up into theirs, Marco Palace following, until he had pinned them against the back of a chair or against a wall, there to be overwhelmed with more argument, fresh enthusiasm, and a pair of gleaming eyes. A painful consciousness of his own lack of advantages was not the only reason for the feelings with which Joe regarded Marco Palace. He did not have much difficulty convincing himself that I enjoyed my talks with old Marco, as he always called him, far more than I enjoyed my talks with him. This was only natural, he was at pains to assure me, brushing aside my protests with an irritable wave of the hand. After all, Marco Palace and I had a lot in common. We had both read all sorts of difficult books that he had not read, and knew all sorts of learned words that he did not know, and probably never would. Naturally, we got on well together. Naturally, I preferred his company to that of someone who had only seen life in the raw and who could only speak from his own experience. When Joe was in that sort of mood, there was little one could do except wait for the storm to blow over. As he himself recognised in his more reasonable moments, the fact that I enjoyed Marco Palace's company did not mean that I did not enjoy his. Different as the two men were in so many respects, I appreciated them both, liked them both, wished them both well, and only regretted that, owing to Joe's difficult temperament, they were unable to get on better together. Not for the first, and certainly not for the last time in my life, I found myself in the uncomfortable position of being friends with two people who, for one reason or another, could not or would not be friends with each other. Having come to know Marco Palace, it was not long before I came to know some of the people in his circle. One of the most likeable of these was a flat-faced, shaven-headed young Tibetan in brown chuba and yellow sash, who greeted me with a smile of unusual friendliness and intelligence. His name was Lobsang Phuntsok Lalungpa, and from the way in which Marco Palace introduced him, it was clear that he regarded the young man with particular approval. The meeting took place in the cave bungalow on the day that I had been invited for lunch, and on my arrival the brown-clad figure rose to depart, but was prevailed upon to stay for a few more minutes. As I could see from his dress, Lobsang Phuntsok was a monk official in the Tibetan government, and he had been sent to Darjeeling to look after the Tibetan boys who were studying there on government scholarships. Since his English was no better than my Tibetan, we did not have much to say to each other, but when, a few years later, the young Tibetan, no longer shaven-headed, moved to Kalimpong, we became fast friends. Thus our chance meeting at Marco Palace's bungalow eventually bore good fruit. Another likeable person whom I came to know through Marco Palace, but with whom I became at all well acquainted only at a much later date, was the colourful and contradictory Mr. Tharchin. He had been born not in Tibet, but in Ladakh, and was not a Buddhist, but a Christian, in fact a Scottish Presbyterian. Nonetheless, he had an excellent knowledge of Tibetan, both colloquial and classical, and was in great demand as a teacher, especially among the growing number of Western scholars who came to Kalimpong in order to pursue their researches into Tibetan Buddhism. His principal claim to celebrity, however, was the fact that he was the editor, proprietor, printer, and publisher of the Tibet Mirror, which proudly proclaimed itself to be the only Tibetan language newspaper in the world, and which was read from the monastic colleges of Lhasa to the oriental departments of major Western universities, not to mention the foreign offices of Washington, Beijing, London and Moscow, and the Ministry of Home Affairs in New Delhi. The reason it was so widely read was that Mr. Tharchin was violently anti-communist and anti-Chinese, and denounced Chairman Mao and all his works with unsparing vigour in every issue of his paper. Not that the Tibet Mirror came out very frequently. It was certainly not a daily, it was not even a weekly or a monthly. The truth was, it came out whenever Mr. Thatchin had the time and the money to write, print, publish and distribute the shiny tabloid sheets. There had been periods in its history, indeed, when the Tibet Mirror did not appear for months together, or even for a year or two. When the paper did appear, therefore, it was quite an event in the Tibetan-speaking world, both inside and outside Tibet, even though only 400 or 500 copies were printed, and even though some of these took weeks to reach their destination. Now that China had invaded Tibet, however, and communist troops occupied Lhasa, Mr. Thatchin had redoubled his efforts. At least two issues of the Tibet Mirror had appeared in recent months, and Chairman Mao had been denounced more vigorously than ever. For Mr. Thatchin, his paper was now no less than the voice of Free Tibet, a fact which was not without political significance, especially so far as relations between India and China were concerned. When not actually engaged in the production of the Tibet Mirror, Mr. Thatchin printed such things as Bible texts and religious tracts for the Church of Scotland mission, in which he was a lay preacher, besides doing a certain amount of job work for local traders. In this way he kept quite busy, so that unless he was out somewhere explaining the mysteries of Tibetan grammar to a budding Tibetologist, as the breed was beginning to be called, one could usually count on finding him at his compositor's bench or his editorial desk in the small wooden building at Tenth Mile, which was the home of the Tibet Mirror Press. It was to the home of the Tibet Mirror Press, therefore, that Margot Palace took me to meet Mr. Thatchin one morning, some time after we ourselves had become better acquainted. Despite the fact that I belonged to what Mr. Thatchin's missionary colleagues regarded as the enemy camp, the lay preacher received me with a combination of cordiality and courtesy that, as I afterwards came to recognise, was thoroughly characteristic of the man. By sight, at least, he was already quite well known to me. Though this was our first actual meeting, I had seen him several times before, usually when making my way to Nepali Building, and he no doubt had seen me. As if to demonstrate the truth of everything Marco Palace had ever said about the unsuitability of Western dress for the peoples of the East, he habitually wore a shabby, ill-fitting three-piece suit, complete with watch chain, and a greasy felt hat which he doffed repeatedly whenever he met anybody he knew. So badly did his clothes fit him, indeed, that they did not seem to belong to him at all, and it was with some surprise that one saw the scraggy neck emerging from the soiled, collarless shirt. With the head on the neck there was nothing wrong, however, nor with the cheerful and good-humoured expression of the rather foxy-looking face. Despite his bristly grey eyebrows and bad teeth, not to mention the shabby three-piece suit, Mr. Thatchin, in fact, presented a thoroughly agreeable picture as he stood bowing and rubbing his hands in the centre of his little office. The ostensible purpose of our visit was to purchase a few back issues of the Tibet Mirror, which Marco Palace wanted for a friend in England. These Mr. Thatchin was only too happy to supply, and the purchase having been made and many compliments exchanged, we therefore took leave of him without further ceremony. Though the meeting had been a brief one, I was left with an impression of genuine warmth and goodwill, and looked forward to seeing the editor of the Tibet Mirror again before long. On our way back to the development area, Marco Palace confided to me his belief that, despite his connection with the Church of Scotland mission, Mr. Thatchin was still very much a Buddhist at heart. Someone whom I did not meet through Marco Palace, but whom I heard about from him, and who was decidedly not a Buddhist at heart, was the Austrian climber Heinrich Harrer. At the outbreak of war, he had been in Karachi, waiting for the ship that was to take him back to Europe, and he had been interned. After making his escape, he crossed the border into Tibet, and with one companion walked all the way to Lhasa, where he lived for 5 years and became the confidant and tutor of the young Dalai Lama. As the Chinese extended their hold on the country, he decided to leave for India, and was now staying with Marco Palas, writing the account of his experiences, afterwards published as 7 Years in Tibet. When I asked Marco Palas what sort of man the young Austrian was, he replied with an air of cheerful finality, "He's a better type of Nazi." At the same time as I was coming to know people through Mrs. Mitter and Marco Palas, I was also meeting them through Joe. Since his return to Kalimpong, the prickly Upasaka had been giving private tuition in the bazaar and already had a number of pupils, including several wealthy Tibetans. One of these was Yogyal Sadutsang, the youngest of the 5 Sadutsang brothers. As the suffix Tsang, meaning nest or house, indicated, the brothers were from Kham in eastern Tibet, and the import-export firm bearing their name was one of the biggest in the town. Technically, Yogyal was a Getsul, or novice monk, and had spent some time in a monastery, but the only sign of this was that he was still shaven-headed, or at least short-haired. In all other respects, he was very much the would-be English gentleman. Shirt, suit, tie, and shoes were all of the very best, and for him, the best meant English. "But what is the best?" he would inquire anxiously whenever he was buying anything. "Is it English?" One of the comparatively un-English things about him was his inability to speak more than a few words of the English language, and this is where Joe came in. Joe was his English tutor, in the double sense of being the tutor who taught him English and the tutor who was himself English. Joe was the best. Like all Tibetans, Yogyal was convinced, perhaps not unreasonably, that English could be learnt only from an Englishman, not from a Bengali or a Nepali. It could be learnt all the more easily if you went and stayed with the Englishman, or better still, if the Englishman came and stayed with you. Yogyal had therefore invited Joe to move into his spacious flat at 10th Mile, and Joe was still trying to decide whether or not to accept the offer. Such was Yogyal's insistence that everything about him should be English that, when Joe brought him to the guest cottage to see me, I could not help wondering if he had come in search of an English domestic chaplain, someone who would light butter lamps and recite prayers for him every day, preferably in English. In appearance, the technical Getsul was a podgy, unattractive little man of about 30, with a receding hairline and a Hitlerian moustache. While Joe was out of the room, he squeezed my hand and started rubbing himself against me. I decided that I did not want to be his domestic chaplain, however English it might help him to be. Some weeks later, Joe moved into the flat at 10th Mile and stayed there with Yogyal for a few months before moving into a place of his own. During this time, he was able to convince the would-be Englishman that he ought to support the English monk's efforts to propagate the Dharma through the medium of the English language, and eventually he donated 100 rupees to the YMBA. It was not through Joe, I think, that I met the young Newar, who became associated with us at about this time. Ratnaman had heard about the YMBA in Lhasa, and being of an alert, inquiring turn of mind, on his arrival in Kalimpong, made a point of coming to see me. Round-faced and rose-cheeked, he had rather black eyebrows and a pair of close-set eyes, the expression of which I described as shrewd and Joe as suspicious. Though little more than 20, he already had considerable business experience, having helped his father run the family business in Lhasa for the past 3 or 4 years. Since he had been educated in Darjeeling, his English was quite good. He also spoke Tibetan, his mother, in fact, being Tibetan. Like many Newar traders who spent much time in Lhasa, his father had 2 wives, one in Nepal and one in Tibet, and Ratnaman had elder brothers in Kathmandu whom he had never seen. Before long, he was taking an active part in the running of the YMBA and eventually replaced Gyan Jyoti as treasurer. That news of the YMBA had penetrated as far north as Lhasa was highly encouraging. It had also penetrated as far south as Madras. Since the end of the previous year, I had been receiving letters and poems from a Sinhalese Buddhist girl who was trained to be a nurse at the Christian Medical College, Vellore, one of the best-known medical institutions of the country. Sujata Etiarachi, as she signed herself, proposed that an organisation of the young women of India, similar in aim and scope to the YMBA, should be started under the name of the Vistaka Fellowship, and in this connection she wanted to come and see me. By the time she arrived in Kalimpong, however, she had changed her mind about the Vistaka Fellowship and had decided to start a Buddhist nursing order instead. And on this subject, we therefore had several talks, besides discussing poetry, the revival of Buddhism in India, and a number of other topics. Since she had been brought up as an Orthodox Theravada Buddhist, she refused to sit on a chair in my presence, so that Joe was obliged to spread a carpet for her on the floor. This led to his making caustic remarks about Mary Magdalene sitting at the feet of Jesus Christ. No one ever wanted to sit at his feet, he declared with mock indignation. He was only a humble upasaka and had no time to spare for all the wonderful and idealistic things that we were interested in talking about. Sometimes Sujata wore her special Kandyan dress. This was a chiton-like affair of white silk, gathered in at the waist and bosom with slender silver chains, thus producing a slightly flounced effect. It was worn, so she informed us, only by women belonging to the Sinhalese aristocracy. But though the style suited her well enough, the unrelieved whiteness of the material made her dark brown face and arms look almost black in comparison. After spending about a week in Kalimpong and discussing all her plans and projects with me in great detail, Sujata returned to Vellore. Though nothing ever came of the Buddhist nursing order, I continued to receive letters and poems from her for a long time to come. Perhaps my strangest encounter during this time I spent at Burma Raja's guest cottage was one that took place at the beginning of the year. 1951 was the year of the census, the first to be held in India since independence, and one fine January day I received a visit from the official enumerator. He was a Bengali, and as it transpired, an Orthodox Hindu, and there took place between us an exchange along some such lines as the following. What is your religion? Buddhist. That is impossible. You cannot be Buddhist. Buddhism is not a separate religion. It is part of the great Hindu religion. Buddhism is what you are by caste. I cannot agree with that. Buddhism does not believe in the caste system, and therefore a Buddhist has no caste, especially not a monk. Besides, I was born in England, and we don't have any caste system there. Don't teach me how to enumerate you. Your religion is Hindu. Your caste is Buddhist, and I shall enter you in the form accordingly. The greater part of the population being illiterate, it was the enumerator who completed the census return, not the enumerated. In that case, I must protest. Much as I protested, however, the enumerator remained adamant. As a Hindu by religion and a Buddhist by caste, was I therefore officially enumerated. How many Orthodox Hindu enumerators there were at work in West Bengal, I wondered. And how had all the Bhutia, that is, locally born Tibetan, Nyuar, Tamang, Lepcha, Bhutanese and Sikkimese Buddhists in Darjeeling District been enumerated? If my own case was anything to go by, the census returns for 1951 would not be very reliable, at least so far as the figures for Buddhists were concerned. Not for the first time in recent years, I realised how implacable the opposition was, and how determined was Orthodox Hinduism to contain its hated rival. It was not going to be easy to revive Buddhism in the land of its birth. End of chapter 9.